This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in this morning. Thanks for joining us. We've got a great show here for the last hour. Planned here for you. Donald Trump appears to be the Republican nominee in the 2016 presidential race, but it may take a little more time for some Michigan Republicans to come around to the reality and kind of embrace it. Attorney General Bill Schuette was talking with reporters yesterday. You know, he was the former public face of the Jeb Bush campaign here in Michigan, and he was asked by reporters if he'd support the GOP nominee, Donald Trump. His answer was, "Our goal needs to be defeating Hillary Clinton. I'm not turning the keys of America over to Hillary Clinton." And as reporters peppered him with questions for about, about 3 or 4 minutes, I don't think he ever mentioned the name Donald Trump one time, which isn't exactly a ringing endorsement. Let's see what our next guest thinks about Donald Trump as the Republican nominee. He's Tim Walberg. He is the congressman in the 7th Congressional District. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning. It's good to talk to, I guess we have a combination here of print dealing with the broadcast media. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Congressman. So Donald Trump, it appears he's going to be the nominee here for Republicans. Is he somebody that you can support in November?
Well, I mean, I think the question is, and then we all want to talk about him and talk about the Republican Party and the challenges that are there. We're a party that's broad-based. It's a party that is looking at a lot of challenges that have come as a result of, I think you'd say, the type of or the lack of Democrat leadership that has been in the White House for the past almost 8 years now. And I'm committed to the fact that I will do everything possible to make sure that Hillary Clinton does not succeed Barack Obama, because we know what's happened with this administration. It's not been good. And we know exactly what will happen with Hillary, because she's told us already. And so I will do everything in my power to make sure that our nominee is the winner and that Hillary Clinton does not take the White House and lead America down a ever-increasing negative path.
Now, last fall, you had said that other Republicans could, learn from Donald Trump. Is that something you still subscribe to?
Well, I think more than that, I subscribe to the fact that he has spoken to the mood of this country, having done 35 live town halls last year and on track to do that this year. I've heard the frustration, the worry, the fear, the anger of America's people in the 7th District. And I think he did speak to that, those issues, those concerns, and talked about desire to make America great. And I think that's what generally the American public wants. We've heard that in Washington, I hope, more clearly than ever before. And we've heard people that are concerned that America is not the place that they want to leave to their kids and their grandkids. And so I guess I'm going to spend my time continuing to try to develop a country and be at least the vote that I have in Congress, which is no different than any other member of Congress. We all have one vote, including the Speaker of the House, to try to make America what it was intended to be and designed by the Constitution to be, the greatest place of liberty and opportunity that the world has ever seen. And I think we showed that, and we can get back to that. So I think that's the message that America's people want to hear. But more than that, they want to see people working for that. And I think, inserting a little personal point here, I think my record shows that that's the direction I've taken for my 7 years and now leading in 8 years in Congress.
Well, definitely the Democratic Congressional Committee is going to try and attach you to Trump as much as it can. I got a press release from them yesterday. It was titled Tim Walberg, Welcome to the Trump Ticket. In it, they have a quote that says that now that Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee, Tim Walberg should get the talking points ready for defending Trump and his dangerous views that insult women, trample on the Constitution, and make America less safe. No amount of distancing and sidestepping can change the fact that Tim Walberg is on the Trump ticket and the party has paved the way for his nomination. You're up for re-election, obviously, this year, and so there's a lot of politics going on here. Is it going to be more difficult with Trump at the top of the ticket for you to hold on to your seat this fall?
Well, this is the normal stuff. They'll come from the other side because, frankly, they don't have those same concerns with me that they can express to the people. I've not had a war on women. In fact, my legislation that they can, if they look at, and the voter will look at, has been to do the right things for women and for children and for people in need, the heroin, opiate issue. I've been a leader in that, and it worked in a bipartisan fashion. Debbie Dingell and I just recently introduced legislation together on that issue. And so we've been working. Politics will be politics, and they're going to have a challenge to deal with their nominee, Hillary Clinton, who said of Benghazi, what difference does it make? Who has been caught with email scandals, fraud, waste, and abuse that has gone on in the Democrat Party. So those are political issues, but my time has been spent on trying to deal with what two out of three people in America think, and that's that America's headed in the wrong direction. We need to balance the budget. My votes have been there. We need to make health care more affordable. My votes have been there. We need to reduce the tax burden and create jobs and opportunity, train our young people for the jobs of the real world. My votes and efforts have all been there. So, I mean, that's going to be the campaign. But right now, I still have a lot of work that I'm responsibly be part of in a positive way in Washington. And frankly, I think that will sell pretty well in this district. If it doesn't, America has decided to be something different. But I'm pretty pleased with this district and the people that I meet that are lovers of America, the American ideal, and we're going to put ourselves with those people.
Isn't it interesting? We'll touch on some of the stuff in Congress here in the next segment, but isn't it interesting to listen to folks say, you know what, I could never support Donald Trump. Other people say, I could never support Hillary Clinton. They both have high negatives, but in the end, one of them is going to win, right? I mean, is this going to be one of those races where I dislike this person a little more than that person, and that's how I'm going to vote?
Well, you know, that's American politics. People decide, and frankly, I think people are angry with the direction that that life has been going here in this country. And for that reason, sometimes they are willing to say, doggone it, I may not have the best candidate to vote for, but I'm going to make a point. And in America, we've seen times in the past. We went through a civil war. Remember that. We went through, in my lifetime, in the Vietnam War. We had the struggles on campuses. I had to step over some of my fellow students' bodies to get the class in 1969-70. We had a Democrat National Convention in Chicago, where I lived at the time, that Mayor Daley brought the troops out to break down the violence and the demonstrations that were going on. We've had difficult times, race riots, all of that.
Yeah, we have indeed. We have indeed. We've got to get to break here real quick. Congressman Tim Walberg will be back right after this. Hang with us.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in today. Joining us on the other end of the line is Congressman Tim Walberg for a second segment. Thanks for holding with us. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
We had Barack Obama, the president of the United States, in Flint yesterday, and he was trying to assure folks in Flint that things would be all right. He's expecting some money to come from the federal government, but Congress has not been too quick to get any federal funding for the city of Flint. Give our listeners a little update on what's going on in Congress in regards to that issue.
Well, it's we did approve some initially, and it's encouraging that a bill that we sent in a bipartisan fashion with all of the Michigan delegation members supporting an Upton bill that was started in his committee with Dan Kildee has gone to the Senate. The Senate wrestled with that. My good friend, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, along with our Senator Stabenow, worked out a solution that ultimately met some challenges. They have come to another conclusion, and it appears that is going to go through the Senate and come to the House, and we can move it toward Flint. I think the President, I applaud things that he does when he does it right. When he was in Flint yesterday, he indicated to them that this is not a place for politics and placing blame right now. It was a failure at all levels, but we are attempting to fix it, and we'll get it fixed. And I think that's an encouraging word for Flint. With the governor drinking the water, with the president coming and saying we're working to solution, that now let's move forward and make sure that that doesn't stop, and also the 1,400 other communities at least around this country are taking action in the same area to make sure that their citizens are protected and understand that that the challenges that have been let go and need to be picked up and ultimately move on towards solutions that to do the right things for our people and get on with what America can be.
Now, what is in the Senate right now is a $220 million aid package that might have a chance of passing. It would provide for an immediate $100 million that Flint could access for infrastructure aid after submitting a plan to the EPA. I'm reading CBS News here. It would also invest millions in a national registry to track health effects of children exposed to lead, among other things. What's the chances of something like that passing the House, $220 million?
I think a strong chance of doing that. Again, it's the right thing to do, and it's paid for. And that's the one thing I looked at, and knowing that Senator Inhofe was working strongly with it, we knew that it would use the right program. It would take dollars from the place where the authority has been given for those dollars to be used. And it's also not just for one city, Flint. It can be used by Flint. It can be used by other cities. But having said that, this was put in place for Flint. And so I don't doubt any way, shape, or form that Flint will receive the benefit of it. But it also can have positive effects for the rest of our country as well.
We still have a few more weeks of session yet before the summer recess. What do you see being a top burner issue for Congress?
Well, top burner issue for Congress, of course, is the budget. And we want to see a budget document go through, and that's where negotiations are taking place, both sides of the aisle and both sides of the Capitol building. That I hope will take place soon so we can see further development of the 12 appropriations budget bills. Already action is being taken on that in committee. I think we'll have up to about 7 of those bills ready in the not-too-distant future for Congress to take action on. We would hope that the agreement that was made with Senator Reid to not filibuster, if the basic funding level was left in place so the Senate could debate on it. I'd love to see now Senator Cruz and Senator Rubio and Sessions and Cotton and others debate with Senator Schumer and Senator Reid issues of funding that would meet the needs of America's people, but also understand that we have a debt and a deficit problem in this country that the American people expect us to address. And I'd love to see the Senate reduce unnecessary expenditures and send that back to the House to work out in a conference committee and send the budgets to the president. That's what we ought to do. And the Senator Reid has held that up for 7 years. It's time to do the right thing and pass a real live budget. I'm certainly there to do the work. I want to see that achieved and do the right thing for our country.
Isn't it even conceivable to pass a balanced budget right now?
Oh, it's absolutely conceivable. We have done that since 2011 by hook or by crook, standing up to the president, his sequestration challenge and everything else, and said no. Back in 2011, in a bipartisan plan, the Ryan Murray budget plan, that set a balanced agenda that kept us on balance in a 10-year approach going from 2011 to 2021. We are still on that track by simply saying, Mr. President, we love you, man, but we will not increase taxes and we will not increase spending. And so this Congress, for now the fifth year in a row, has passed a balanced spending plan, even though it's been done by CRs and omnibuses. We've passed that, and that's the first time since the Congress of the Korean War. That's something that we need to talk about. Is it an end? No, absolutely not. We have a debt that's increasing. It's now above $19 trillion, and that comes from mandatory spending areas of the budget. We don't have control of that until we have a president who will sign repealer bills of projects, of agencies, of plans that are costing the American people their future. And we've got to get serious about that. So we'll keep working, but it's one step at a time. And sometimes you have to do that with aggressive challenges from the other side. But in the end, we hope the American people will be heard.
All right. We've been talking with the U.S. Congressman from the 7th Congressional District. He is Tim Walberg. Thanks for joining us on the Steve Gruber Show this morning.
Good to be with you. And this is the National Day of Prayer, so don't miss that either.
All right. Thank you for that word of wisdom. He's Tim Walberg, and he is the congressman from the 7th Congressional District. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter. We've got a half hour left on the program. Stick with us. We've got a couple guests that you're not going to want to miss. We've also got news at the bottom of the hour here. Until then, stay tuned.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Mullen, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in today. Well, the newest test scores on standardized testing across the country are bad news for centralized education and Common Core, according to Neil McCluskey. He is the director of the Cato Center for Educational Freedom. He joins us on the other end of the line to talk about that. Good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm just fine.
So we've got some test scores from the federal government about how kids are doing across this country, and they don't look good if you're a supporter of centralized education and Common Core. Why is that?
Sure. Well, so first of all, I'd say these are just the latest scores. So we're going to put them in overall context of we've got about 40-some years of scores from something called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a federal test, but it has the benefit of not being a test that has ramifications for schools or students, so there's no impetus for people to cheat on it. They're not going to lose money or not graduate or something like that. So they don't game it, they don't cheat on it, and so it's a pretty good barometer of how we're doing. And so the latest test scores came out for 12th graders, and what they showed was we actually had a drop in most scores, that is overall and then by various subgroups of race and income and parental education between 2013 and 2015. Now, anytime you have a drop, it's not good. But this is in the context of 40-some years of basically stagnant scores for 17-year-olds. And at the same time, we've had the federal government take way more power, authority over education. We've seen almost a doubling in spending. We've seen a lot more state control over education. And the very clear story we're getting from these National Assessment of Educational Progress exams is that at least by the time students are ready to graduate, to actually finish the K-12 system, they're not making any sorts of improvements, even though we've doubled the spending, even though we've greatly centralized power. And what that ought to tell us is these things don't work. We need to do something different.
Now, is it the centralized programming, or is it more about Common Core? Because I know that we've got some higher standards, particularly here in the state of Michigan, and the tests are just a little harder than they were before.
Yeah, well, so what we can't say with definitively from these scores is that the Common Core has caused these decreases. Now, it's also important to note that we had 4th and 8th grade scores come out about 6 or 7 months ago. They also dropped, and that is during in grades that have seen a lot of Common Core. And if you look at the states that didn't implement versus the ones that did, What you see is the ones who didn't implement actually had better test scores. Now, we don't know definitively, again, that that's Common Core, but there's at least good reason to be suspicious that Common Core, and especially the way it's been implemented, which was a rushed implementation of states saying, we want to get federal money, because in 2009, the federal government said, if you want something called Race to the Top money, $4.35 billion, you've got to adopt Common Core, you've got to adopt Common Core tests, and you've got to implement Common Core. And you saw lots of states just scramble to do this to get the money, and you've seen all sorts of problems of curricula not being aligned. You've seen lots of people who have rejected actually the math in particular, which often doesn't make a lot of sense. And so you have sort of this chaos. And it could very well be that just the chaos of this federally driven, federally coerced adoption of a particular set of standards and specific tests that the federal government pay for caused all sorts of problems that we're paying for. And the reality is also that we haven't seen centralized standards ever lead to any sort of major meaningful improvement in schools.
We're talking with Neil McCluskey of the Cato Center for Educational Freedom. And you mentioned the Common Core and the math is a bit more difficult. And I haven't been able to wrap my head around how they're teaching math under the Common Core, but it is completely different than just adding a couple numbers together and just knowing that 4 + 5 = 9, isn't it?
Yeah, and this has thrown a lot of people off. And the first thing you have to get through is a lot of people tell you who are Common Core supporters, well, Common Core is just standards. It doesn't tell you how to do something. It just tells you what you need to be able to do. It is not curriculum. When people tell you that, the first thing you need to say is, well, hold back off for a second. Are standards supposed to have an impact on your curriculum? What is the point of standards if it isn't supposed to help drive your education in a particular way? And, of course, they'll say, obviously, that's the point of standards. Then you really need to get into the math standards. And almost by the nature of math, you see that math builds on itself. And it has to say very specifically what you need to do, what you need to know how to do. And it often says how you do it, because that then impacts what you can do at the next level and the level after that and the level after that. So you see that what it says is, well, we're going to have you do a lot more of what's called base 10, which is when you take your addition or subtraction, rather than doing it the way that you might have learned and that I learned, where, you know, you put your numbers on top of each other and you'll carry a 1 or something like that. They say, no, you take every number and you break it into 10s. And then you take those 10s or 100s and you add them together. Then you add, so if you got 100s, you add the 100s, the 10s, the 1s, after you've broken them all up, and you've gone at that point through a multi-stage process that you didn't have to follow before. And the argument is, well, 10s are easy to think about, to conceptualize, so it's easier. And what you find is it's not easier, at least for a lot of people. Now, does that mean that going in that direction may be wrong or is wrong for all kids? It doesn't mean that. But the problem is the Common Core was something the federal government said, you adopt this now without it having been tested, even without it having been finished being written. And it does a lot of things, as you've noticed, that are totally different from how math was taught before. It's never been tested. And you're finding that people are rejecting it because it doesn't even make intuitive sense. And the problem, the root problem, is it's not something that was adopted organically, that was tested, that was rewritten, that was tried in a few places. It was imposed on everyone, and it simply wasn't ready to go.
Well, and people learn math in different ways, right? I mean, some people do memorization just fine. Other people have to have a better concrete understanding of things. So to push a particular way of teaching math on people, you're obviously going to get some pushback on that.
Yeah, so it's a problem on two levels. The first most fundamental problem is all kids are different. Different kids learn different things in different ways at different rates. And that's just basic human reality. And the basic notion of Common Core is we're going to have one national standard. Every kid, everywhere, doing everything the same way at the same time. And, of course, that makes no sense. And then the other problem is they didn't test it. And if you have one standard, you can't have competing standards to show better ways to do things.
Neil McCluskey's the director of Cato Center for Educational Freedom. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin filling in. We'll be back.
Genuine Michigan common sense on display every day.
Men who hold high places must
You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter. Fueling up right now with little bakes and cakes here at Lansing. They dropped off their regular Thursday shipment of goodies. I got a cheese Danish here. This thing is top notch. Bacon cakes. They're right off Kalamazoo there. You get off 127. Good stuff. Anyway, joining us here for the final segment of the Steve Gruber Show, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, a worldwide leader in funding research to cure diabetes, is holding some fundraisers here in the coming days. And joining us to talk about that is Scott Weaver. Good morning.
Good morning, Kyle. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell our listeners about what type of fundraisers we've got going on for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation.
Well, there's a couple different events. First of all, ourselves with the Douglas J. Companies will be raising money over the next 60 days or so, raising funds for JDRF. But there is we host a golf outing. This year will be our 15th annual golf outing benefiting the JDRF. Will be held on July 18th. We do a raffle with a golf ball drop from a helicopter that's pretty exciting at the end of the day. And there's also the JDRF puts on the walk, which is on the campus of Michigan State University. And they do that. Well, this year will be held on Saturday, August 6th.
Now,
and the walkers from all over.
So Douglas J. has raised over $200,000 for clean water in the past 6 years, worked with global green grants funds. VEDA has so far provided grants in 84 countries. And you guys are really involved in these in this Diabetes Research Foundation, the JDRF. Talk about your company's involvement and how that came to be.
Well, we've been, Douglas J. was founded in 1967 by my father, Doug Weaver, and one of his core values and part of the company's DNA was always giving back to the communities and the communities in which give us an opportunity to do our work and earn our living. And as some of those charities over the years have evolved and changed, we have three main charities that we work with this year, and that's, you're right, the Clean Water through OVEDA, the Alliance for the Great Lakes, is the local division that receives those funds, as our Great Lakes are the world's largest freshwater source. We also work with the JDRF, and we've been doing that now for about 18 years. We've been working with the JDRF, raising funds for them. And our other one is Shining a Light, and that's a women's empowerment group. They have trained women over in Tanzania, Africa, to do a skill, a little bit about clean water and health care over there, and help them find local jobs in the community. So those are our three main charities that we're raising funds for this year. And again, it's just something we've always done is to give back. And we get our staff involved and our team involved in that. We also, with our six different schools, we encourage our students and teach them about giving back and get them engaged in the efforts as well.
We're talking with Scott Weaver. You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of MERS, filling in today. Tell our listeners again about this golf outing. Where is it? When is it?
We are scheduled for our golf outing this year. It will be Monday, July 18th at Walnut Hills in East Lansing, Michigan. And we will have, I think it's about a 10 o'clock shotgun is when we start. There's still plenty of opportunities for golfers and or sponsorship. Certainly visit our website, douglasj.com, for more information or stop into any of our six Michigan locations for more information on that. Many different ways to get involved, through sponsorship. We can also involved in the helicopter ball drop raffle that takes place at the end of the outing. With a chance to win up to $2,000 if your golf ball is the one that lands closest to the hole. And even the one furthest away gets $200. So, and then again, all those proceeds from that raffle will go directly to the JDRF. And I did want to add, too, with the JDRF, it's one of the few where, 80% or more of the money donated and raised goes directly into research for finding a cure. And there's been so much progress on that. It's been absolutely great.
So this helicopter ball drop, they literally drop golf balls out of the sky.
Yeah, we do. At the end of the outing, the helicopter lands in between the 9th and the 18th green. And it's been myself. My daughter's been up before. She was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes about 18 years ago. And what the purpose of why we became so involved. But someone will raise up in that elevator, usually two big bags, depending on how many balls are sold. And they'll make a couple circles around the course. And, you know, everyone's kind of gathered around, certainly from a safe distance. And they just start dumping those big bags out with hundreds of golf balls dropping down out of the sky. And, again, the one closest to the hole. I don't think we've had one actually go in yet. But whoever's closest to is the one that takes home that $2,000.
Gosh, what would happen if two balls fell into the hole?
Well, the way the hole is designed, there's one at the bottom, or it's kind of coned. They cut it so they can see which ball fell in first.
Oh, okay.
So we do have a way to figure that one out. We thought of that.
Thinking ahead there. Well, very good. Yeah. We've been speaking with Scott Weaver from Douglas J. Thanks for joining us on the Steve Gruber Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Kyle. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in today. Also be filling in for Steve Gruber on next Tuesday and Thursday. You can tune into this station right here to join us. Thanks to Alec Clark and Rob Burkhart for producing.